Today's episode is sponsored in part by Modern Mammals, creators of a new hair washing product for men. You can help support Based on a True Story when you use the code BOATSPODCAST at modernmammals.com for 10% off. I've really been enjoying their shampoo light bar as an alternative to traditional shampoo. And I know it's in the name, but honestly, when I first used it, I was surprised at just how light and airy it feels. It reminds me of using a bar of soap for your hair, except it's even better than that because if you're like me, you don't like the residue that some actual bars of soap leave behind. And the shampoo light bar is easy to wash out without leaving any residue behind. Modern Mammals also focuses on creating products that help you keep your hair's natural oils so it's not left feeling poofy and frizzy. Go to modernmammals.com and use code BOATSPODCAST for 10% off. Again, that's modernmammals.com for 10% off with promo code BOATSPODCAST. Don't forget to use the promo code BOATSPODCAST so they know I sent you. Thanks, Modern Mammals. Okay, let's start today's episode. Hello, and welcome to Based on a True Story, the podcast that compares your favorite Hollywood movies and TV shows with history. On today's episode, we're continuing our series on the HBO miniseries, Chernobyl. Now, there are 5 episodes in HBO's miniseries, so there will be 5 episodes in our series as well. And we're going to be looking at episode number 2 today, which is called Please Remain Calm. This episode first aired on May 13th, 2019. Since this is episode number 2, if you haven't already, I would recommend going back to listen to episode number 1 because a lot of what happened in that episode will be important for things that are happening in this episode and the rest of the series. You can find that whole series over at basedonatruestorypodcast.com/Chernobyl. Before we start our story today, though, let's set up our game. 2 truths and a lie. If you're new to the show, here's how it works. I'm about to say 3 things. 2 of them are true, which means 1 is an all-out lie. Are you ready? Okay, here they are. Number 1, Legasov and Chervina were both real people on the Chernobyl Commission, but Komyuk was not. Number 2, they really did drop sand and boron on Chernobyl. Number 3, citizens were told to evacuate Pripyat with over 6 hours' notice. Got them? Okay, now as you're listening to our story today, your challenge is to identify which one of those was the lie. And of course, we'll do a recap at the end of the episode to see how well you did. So, how much of the second episode of Chernobyl really happened? I'm Dan Lefebvre, and this is Based on a True Story. Episode number 2 starts with some text on the screen to let us know we're now at the Belarusian Institute for Nuclear Energy in Minsk. It's 8:30 a.m. on Saturday, April 26, 1986, so that's 7 hours after the explosion. Ulana Kumyuk, who's played by Emily Watson, gets woken up by her colleague, Misha. They're the only ones there because it's a Saturday, but they're both workaholics, so they're at work anyway. Misha remarks how hot it is in the room and goes to open a window. Second after he does, the decimeter alarm starts going off to indicate high radiation levels. He immediately closes the window. A leak? The Americans? Ulana opens the window quickly to gather a sample from the outside of the glass. And then she takes it into the lab where she tests it. The printer spits out a piece of paper and she takes it back to her colleague. It's uranium decay. U-235, reactor fuel. They call the closest nuclear plant. It's not them. What's the next closest? Chernobyl? Well, there's no way it's them. They're 400 kilometers away, and it's too far to be leaking that kind of radiation. They'd have to be completely split open. But maybe they know something anyway. Ulana gives them the call. It rings and rings and rings. Now they're concerned. This scene is made up for the series, although there are elements of truth to it. For example, in the first few shots, we see a mural just before the text on screen setting up the location as being at the Belarusian Institute for Nuclear Energy in Minsk.
But that mural is not in Minsk. It's actually at the Institute for Nuclear Research in Kyiv in Ukraine and not Belarus. That's 530 kilometers or 330 miles away from Minsk. So it is a real mural, a beautiful mural, and it is tied to nuclear energy. So I can see why they'd want to include it in the series. But that's not really one of the biggest changes. One of the biggest changes in that first sequence comes from probably one of the biggest fictional elements in the entire series. Emily Watson's character, Ulana Kumyuk, she's not real. She's a composite character. So, of course, there couldn't have been a way where she noticed uranium-235 because, well, she's not a real person. Although, as we learned in our last episode, uranium-235 really is what they used to enrich the uranium-238 that was in the fuel rods for the reactor at Chernobyl. So, elements of truth. If you haven't already, there's a great series of podcasts released by HBO with the writer of the miniseries, Craig Mazin. In that series, he talks about how and why he created the composite character of Ulana Kumyuk. In a nutshell, there were just too many real people, hundreds of scientists, as you can imagine, for something like this, everybody trying to figure out what happened at Chernobyl. It'd be impossible to have hundreds of characters in this series and still be able to track who is who. So that's why they made up the character of Ulana Kumyuk, who they could turn into someone doing many of the real things those hundreds of scientists did, just in a way that's a lot easier to keep track of as viewers. Something else also worth pointing out is that even if the specifics of the sequence we see in the opening of the episode isn't entirely accurate to what really happened, the basic gist is true. First, to clarify, the place where this is happening in the series is in modern-day Belarus. That's an independent country now, although in 1986, it was part of the Soviet Union as Belarusian SSR. The SSR stands for Soviet Socialist Republics, the same thing as in USSR or the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. What I mean by the opening sequence being basically true is that it is true the radiation from Chernobyl drifted into the country we now know as Belarus. In fact, most of it did. Some experts say that about 70% of the radiation from Chernobyl drifted into Belarus. Of course, not all of that happened in the first 7 hours like we see in the opening sequence, but nevertheless, the impact of the Chernobyl accident on Belarus is an important part of the story. And the mention of iodine-131 is also true at the beginning. Iodine-131 is a byproduct of nuclear fission in reactors like the one at Chernobyl. When there's too much of it in the atmosphere, it'll get absorbed into your thyroid gland, thereby increasing the risk of thyroid cancer. There are still studies being done on residents of Belarus due to their exposure of Chernobyl's fallout. One of the studies, which I'll link to on this episode's page over at basedonatruestorypodcast.com, it concluded that childhood exposure to internal iodine-131 as a result of the Chernobyl accident is tied to increased risk of neoplastic thyroid nodules. Without getting too sidetracked with the medical side, that's a tumor that can be cancerous. So basically, the study on people who were children in Belarus at the time of the Chernobyl accident has proven to be linked to an increased risk of cancer later in life.
As I'm recording this right now, on the other side of my door is my cat. He's always wherever I am as I'm working on the podcast. He watches all the movies with me, and he lets me know when it's time to stop working by sitting on my keyboard. I love the little guy. And as a pet owner, that means there are expenses like vet bills that can pop up, and sometimes that's unexpected. That's why I was happy to learn about today's sponsor, EarnIn, because they can help make sure that I've got the money to cover those unexpected vet bills. EarnIn is an app that gives you access to your pay as you work, up to $100 per day, or up to $750 per pay period. Now you can join over 3.5 million customers. Get the peace of mind that comes with EarnIn. Download EarnIn today, spelled E-A-R-N-I-N, in the Google Play or Apple App Store. When you download the EarnIn app, type in True Story under podcast when you sign up. It'll really help the show. True Story under podcast. EarnIn is a financial technology company, not a bank. Subject to your available earnings, daily max, pay period max, and location. See earnin.com/TOS for details. Bank products are issued by Evolve Bank and Trust, member FDIC. Thanks, EarnIn.
Going back to the series, as the series shifts back to Valery Legasov and Boris Sherdubina being pulled into the story to figure out what's going on. We're faced with something we've seen a little bit of in the first episode too. I'm speaking about how the series mentions the decimeter reading of 3.6 Röntgen. In the first episode, we see this reading. We didn't really talk about it much then because we're going to now. But in the second episode, we see that Legasov isn't happy with this reading. What bothers him about this is that he knows 3.6 Röntgen is the maximum amount the lower quality decimeters will go. So it's not necessarily an accurate reading. It's just as high as they'll go. That whole concept is true. The decimeters that they were using at first maxed out at 3.6 Röntgen. And as I was watching this episode in particular, I was confused about why the number 3.6. That just seems so random. But once I researched it, it made a lot more sense. To understand this more, we have to understand what that unit of measurement even means, a Röntgen. It's named after a person named Wilhelm Röntgen. He won the very first Nobel Prize in Physics in 1901 for his 1895 discovery of what we now know as X-rays. Then in 1928, his last name was adopted as the first international measurement for ionizing radiation, like happens at a nuclear power plant. It's worth pointing out that in 1998, after the timeline of our story today, that unit was redefined. So it's not really used for ionizing radiation anymore. But it was during the series, so that's what we're going to be using. Now, if we do the math to figure out how many seconds there are per hour, that'd be 3,600. And that's why the decimeters that they used at first can only go up to 3.6 Röntgen, because they were maxing out at 1,000 microRöntgen per second. There are a million microRöntgen per one Röntgen. So 3,600 seconds times 1,000 equals 3,600,000 microRöntgen, or 3.6 Röntgen per hour. So what does that mean for safety, though? After all, radiation is something that occurs in nature and everywhere all around us to some degree, most of it coming from the sun. While there are a lot of different factors that can determine how safe levels are, not every person is the same, not all factors are the same, but generally speaking, 60 microRöntgens per hour is safe. That's 0.00006 Röntgen per hour. 120 microRöntgens an hour starts to get into some dangerous territory. With that in mind, it would make sense that the decimeters that they had at Chernobyl were sensitive enough to detect up to 1,000 microRöntgens per hour. After all, that's way more than safe. That level is definitely not safe. And the readings they got, just like we see in the series, were maxing out the decimeters. A level of 3.6 Röntgens per hour is detecting levels that are not safe. Of course, if we're looking at what deadly means, that's different than not safe. It'd take about 5 hours of constant exposure to 500 Röntgens per hour, or 500 million microRöntgen per hour, to prove fatal for a human. So no, 3.6 Röntgens is not safe, but it's a far cry from the fatal amount of 500 Röntgen. And it kind of starts to make sense for that to be a maximum level if you think about 120 microRöntgen being considered a risk in everyday life. 1,000 should be a big warning. When they ran the decimeter in the control room, it read 800 microRöntgens per second. That's a lot. But then when they ran it in another part of the control room, it went past the 1,000 microRöntgens that the decimeter could read. After the explosion on April 26, 1986, and after the decimeters read 800 microRöntgen in one part of the control room and then maxed out at 1,000 in another part, Anatoly Dyatlov figured it might be about 5 Röntgens per hour. That's about 1,388 microRöntgens per second. If that's the case, it would make sense why the decimeter would max out. It also makes sense why it wasn't seen as quite the extreme emergency quite yet, because something the series doesn't mention is that the operators at Chernobyl already had a documented plan for the maximum amount of radiation. It was a nuclear power plant, after all. That was 25 Röntgen per hour, which is a little under 7,000 microRöntgen per second. Even at that rate, they were technically allowed to be in there just for a few hours and only in an extreme emergency. So maybe that's why Anatoly Dyatlov didn't consider it to be the emergency we now know it was. But that's pure speculation on my part. It's hard to know what goes through someone's mind. If we go back to the series, though, we're at the point where Valery Legasov and Boris Sherbina are arriving at Chernobyl. We don't see the specific time they arrive via helicopter, but we do see that they've been ordered to go there by Gorbachev himself. The way we see it depicted in the series, Shcherbina is the political leader of the committee digging into the accident, while Legasov is the nuclear scientist to explain how nuclear reactors work, even to Shcherbina. As we mentioned in the last episode, both Valery Legasov and Boris Shcherbina were real people. And the series is correct to explain their roles in investigating the Chernobyl accident. Boris Shcherbina was, as the series suggests, a political leader. His official role at the time was as deputy prime minister in charge of energy for the government. But he didn't have a background in nuclear power. He had a background in oil and gas. Something else to keep in mind was that in 1986, oil and gas were still making a lot of money for the Russian government, more money than nuclear power was. Those two things are why the series is correct to show why Shcherbina was the boss, basically, for the commission, but he wasn't really up on the nuclear side of energy. That's where the other man we see with him comes in, Valery Legasov. Legasov's role at the time was as first deputy to the director of the Kirkuchov Institute of Atomic Energy. In the morning hours of April 26, Shcherbina found out he was in charge of the commission to determine what happened at Chernobyl. After going back to Moscow, he was actually in Siberia, as part of his normal weekend routine to check on various construction sites that he was overseeing, Shcherbina had a chat with his boss about the accident and rounded up some experts, one of them being Legasov, to fly to Pripyat. Legasov found out he was a part of the committee, not from a phone call while he was at home, like we see at the end of the first episode, but rather he was at a state meeting about atomic energy. In that meeting, they actually mentioned the Chernobyl accident, but it was mentioned in passing. It didn't really seem like a big deal. A little bit later, while the meeting was on break, Legasov found out he was being ordered to the airport as part of the state commission to look into the accident. And it is true that Legasov and Shcherbina had a conversation on the flight to the accident zone. They talked about the nuclear industry as a whole, as well as some of the other accidents. In particular, the more recent partial meltdown, more recent as of 1986 when this happened, the more recent partial meltdown of the reactor at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania in the United States. That was in March of 1979. So relatively recent in the minds of another nuclear accident now in 1986. One difference from how we see things happening in the series to reality is the way Shcherbina and Legasov approached Chernobyl. In the series, we can see them flying in helicopters near the power plant. They're close enough to where Legasov can see the core is exposed right away, although Shcherbina isn't quite sure how he can tell that from the position they're in. Legasov points out the ionizing radiation in the air is how he knows. In truth, Legasov and Shcherbina and the rest of the state committee flew into Kyiv. That's about 130 miles or 209 kilometers away from Chernobyl. When they landed in Kyiv, they took cars to the nearby city of Pripyat, where they basically set up their base of operations for the investigation. Oh, and it's daytime in the series, but in truth, they arrived in Pripyat around 8 p.m., about an hour or so after the sun had gone down. With that said, though, the series is correct to show Legasov and the others seeing something not right from afar. Even before they got there, later, Legasov would comment on what it was like when they drove up to Pripyat, saying that the sky near the plant had a deep crimson glow to it. Things were worse than they originally thought. Going back to the series, it's April 27th now, or 30 hours after the explosion. One of the first things they do is to figure out the real readings. Legasov doesn't trust the number they received as being 3.6 Röntgen because he knows that's the maximum of the decimeters that they had. And also, what he's seen with his own eyes makes him think things are a lot worse than 3.6 Röntgen. To get the reading, we see them using a lead-lined truck with a high-range decimeter. General Pikalov offers to drive the truck so no one else takes the risk. After he does that, he comes back and tells Legasov and Shcherbina that the reading is not 3 Röntgen. It's 15,000. General Pikalov is based on a real person who was there. The real Pikalov was in charge of the chemical warfare divisions of the military, so he was there to try to measure the radioactivity. And he did drive a truck like we see in the series to get a more accurate reading. It's still not an entirely accurate reading from everywhere, but it's enough to let everyone know they're dealing with a lot more than they had originally thought. From that, they determined the reaction was still happening. The reactor was still heating up. It wasn't stable and it wasn't cooling down. It was going to get worse if they didn't do something. With that said, though, the reading that we see in this series is true. As you've probably figured out by now, the reading of 3.6 Röntgen per hour was way off. Things were a lot worse than that. And the series is correct to give the number of 15,000, although it's not like that number was universal around the entire power plant. In the series, when Shcherbina asks for the explanation of what 15,000, what that number means, Legasov says, "The fire they're watching with their own eyes is giving off nearly twice the radiation released by the bomb in Hiroshima. That's every hour, hour after hour. And at that point, they're 20 hours since the explosion, so 40 bombs worth by now." This example is made up for the series as a better way of describing what happened. A huge way we know this is because, quite simply, in 1986, we still didn't even really know exactly how much radiation the bombs in Hiroshima gave off. After all, that wasn't a nuclear power plant. They didn't have dosimeters everywhere. We know how powerful the bomb itself was, but we're talking about radiation here. And that bomb was a surprise to a largely civilian population. They didn't have dosimeters at the ready to determine how much radiation people were hit with. In 2018, though, there were some tests done on a jawbone from someone who was in the Hiroshima attack, and they found it absorbed 9.46 grays of radiation. And again, we're hit with yet another form of measurement for radiation. Think of it kind of like how liquid can be measured in volume or in gallons, two different measurements for the same amount of liquid, and depending on what you're measuring. Okay, it's not an exact one-to-one example, because if you're a nuclear engineer, you'll know grays are measuring absorbed radiation compared to Röntgen, which are measuring ionized radiation. But for our purposes today, my point is merely to say that there are different ways of measuring radiation in different ways, absorbed versus ionized and so on. So using a converter online, because I am not a nuclear engineer, I found that 9.46 grays of radiation converts to 1,078,667,351 microRöntgen, or 1,079 Röntgen. So as far as my research is concerned, that number doesn't necessarily equate to 40 Hiroshima bombs. But at that point, it almost doesn't even really matter what the specific numbers are. That's not the survivable 3.6 Röntgen per hour. It's a number that's so high, it simply means if you're in the area, you're going to die. Humans can't survive anywhere near that kind of radiation. It's the kind of deadly radiation that can kill humans many times over. The only thing at that point is just a matter of when you die as a result of the radiation. And that right there brings to light something that we see throughout this series that is very true. Most of these people working on figuring out and dealing with the Chernobyl accident were doing that knowing that they were giving their lives to do so. One of the books I used as a resource for this entire series is called Chernobyl Notebook by Grigory Medvedev. His book offers some of the few firsthand accounts and have been used as a source for many people since then. In his book, Medvedev recounts someone who made that sacrifice. Here is a quote from his book. "Making a preliminary assessment of the situation and the actions of the operating personnel after the explosion, we can say that the turbine operators in the turbine hall, the firemen on the roof, and the electricians headed by Alexander Grigorievich Lilinchenko, deputy chief of the electrical shop, displayed unconditional heroism and self-sacrifice. These people prevented development of the disaster both inside and outside the turbine hall and thus saved the entire plant. Alexander Grigorievich Lilinchenko protecting the young electricians from going unnecessarily into the zone of high radiation himself went into the electrolysis space three times in order to turn off the flow of hydrogen to the emergency generators. When we take into account that the electrolysis space was alongside the pile of debris, fragments of fuel and reactor graphite were everywhere, and the radioactivity was between 5,000 and 15,000 Röntgen per hour, one can get an idea of how highly moral and heroic this 50-year-old man was when he deliberately shielded young lives behind his own.
And then in radioactive water up to his knees, he studied the condition of the switchboxes, trying to supply voltage to the feed water pumps. His total exposure dose was 2,500 rads, enough to kill him 5 times. But after he had received first aid, they injected physiological solution into his vein at the medical station in Pripyat. Lilichenko rushed back to the unit and worked there several more hours. He died a terrible, painful death in Kyiv.
With that quote, we get an idea of just one person who sacrificed their own life to try and stop the damage from getting even worse. It's worth pointing out, though, that while Medvedev said in his book they gave their lives to save the entire plant, if we were to look at the entire story through a lens of history, we know that isn't always the case. Not that it was on purpose, but sometimes the actions they took actually made things worse. One example of this is something we don't see in the series at all, even though it relates to things we've already seen in the series. Remember back when Anatoly Dyatlov was in the control room soon after the explosion? Well, as the firefighters were working to extinguish the fire in the turbine hall, Dyatlov had measured radiation. Of course, the dosimeter showed a value of 3.6 Röntgen per hour and maxed out. A little later, Dyatlov then decided it'd be safer for any non-essential personnel to go to a different building. He didn't think things were as bad as they were, but he still wanted to be safe. It was reactor number 4, unit 4, that had the emergency after all, so he ordered everyone to go to the closest safe reactor nearby. They went to reactor number 3, or unit 3. And to make it even safer for them, he ordered the ventilation in Unit 4 to be turned off so they could crank the ventilation in Unit 3 into high gear. That wouldn't have been a bad idea if the situation was as Dyatlov thought, but the fact was that Unit 4 had exploded. So by turning up the ventilation in Unit 3, they were basically pumping the radioactive air from outside that Reactor 4 was spewing into the air. And that is an example of how someone makes what they think is the best decision at the time, but in reality, it ends up making things worse. If we go back to where we were in the timeline of the series, we see a lot happening on April 27th, the day after the explosion. Since they know it's a big deal, one of the first things we see them trying to do as a resolution is to dump a ton of, well, according to the series, it's actually 5,000 tons of boron and sand. We see the first helicopter trying to deliver its load of boron and sand over the exposed core, and it simply falls apart in the sky. The basic idea of dropping things on the reactor is true, although there is more to the story that we don't see in the series. For example, in the series, we see Legasov asking Chertobina for the 5,000 tons of boron and sand. In truth, Chertobina had the idea to use clay and boron. Legasov asked for 2,000 tons of lead, but he also was the first to admit it probably wouldn't be enough. This was a bad situation to the level he'd never dealt with it before. So in the end, Chertobina ordered 6,000 tons of boron, sand, clay, and lead that they planned on dropping onto the open reactor from helicopters. And there was at least one helicopter that crashed in the process, although I couldn't find anything in my research to suggest it just fell apart in the sky like we see in the series. In fact, there's video footage I'll include in the resources for this episode if you want to watch it. There's video footage of a helicopter crashing as it dropped its contents at Chernobyl. And that was because it got too close to a construction crane and it clipped it and went down. It's not like it fell apart on its own because of the radiation. The purpose for dropping these items was not random. Sand would suffocate the fire. Lead lowered the graphite from the exploded core that was still burning. And if you remember from the first episode, boron was in the control rods to absorb neutrons to slow the nuclear chain reaction. So dropping that with clay would help slow any continuing reaction from getting worse and worse. Something else we don't see in the series was that there were people who didn't like this idea. For example, someone who is not in the series at all was Valentin Fedelenko. He was considered an expert on RBMK reactors. Legasov was a nuclear expert, but not necessarily as experienced with RBMK reactors. In fact, he didn't have any experience with them. When he found out he was on the committee for the Chernobyl accident, his first reaction was to grab any technical information on RBMK reactors and talk to people he knew that had worked with them to get a better idea of the specifics on how they worked. While Legasov was a nuclear expert, Fedulenko was considered the top expert on RBMK reactors specifically. When he arrived in Pripyat on April 27th, he didn't like the idea of dropping sand, clay, and lead on the reactor. A big reason for this was because he knew the reactor's lid had been blown off, but the way it landed was to leave the core partially exposed. He didn't think the helicopters could accurately drop their load onto the partially exposed reactor core. But it happened anyway. By the time April 28th rolled around, 300 tons of materials had been dropped. Another 750 tons on April 29th, another 1,500 tons on April 30th, and another 1,900 tons on May 1st. We're getting a little ahead of the series timeline here, but with purpose, because the amount of material dropped to smother the core ended up being an issue itself. They couldn't just keep doing that because it was so much weight that they thought maybe the reactor would collapse on itself to lower levels of the unit. So that's why they stopped dumping material into the reactor. But that didn't fix the issue. If we go back to the series, things get bad enough that radiation levels are detected as far as Sweden. That happened. And a lot of people think the detection of the radiation by surrounding countries ultimately would become a big reason why the Soviet Union couldn't hide everything. Even though people like Shcherbina, Legasov, and others knew about the accident soon after it happened, most of the world outside the Soviet Union didn't know anything at all had happened until the morning of April 28th. There was a sensor at Sweden's Forsmark nuclear power plant that detected higher than usual radiation. At first, they thought it was a mistake, maybe a broken detector. Maybe it was a leak on site. It was a nuclear power plant, after all. They evacuated their 600 or so staff members as they tried to figure out what was going on. Soon, they figured out it was not internal. But if it was external, what could it be? Maybe a nuclear bomb? Would that mean war had broken out? What could that mean? By the evening of April 28th, it wasn't just Sweden that had detected elevated radiation. Finland and Norway were also getting similar readings. Okay, so it's not nuclear war, it's something else. But everyone has done internal testing and it's not them. These readings are coming from somewhere else. As that alerted them to there being an issue, ultimately that would lead to the Soviet Union being forced to admit there was an accident at Chernobyl. If we go back to the series, one of the major plot points we see happens when the entire city of Pripyat is evacuated. That happened, although there is more to the story than we see in the HBO miniseries. Starting at midnight on April 27th, buses started to arrive in the city of Pripyat with the idea that they would be evacuating civilians. Things were still in a bit of flux. No one knew that it would be a permanent evacuation. On April 27th, 1986, at about 1 p.m., there was an announcement broadcast through the city of Pripyat. Here is an excerpt from that announcement.
Внимание, внимание. Внимание, внимание. Уважаемые товарищи, городской совет народных депутатов сообщает, что в связи с аварией на Чернобыльской атомной электростанции в городе Припяти складывается неблагоприятная радиационная обстановка.
Now, I don't speak Russian. I think we've clarified that throughout this series. So I'll admit that I had to use a translator for this, but that announcement says something like,
attention, attention. The city council informs you that in connection with the accident at the Chernobyl Atomic Power Station, unfavorable radiation conditions are developing in the city of Pripyat. The Communist Party, its officials, and the armed forces are taking necessary steps to fight this. Nevertheless, in order to ensure complete safety for residents, children first and foremost, it has become necessary to carry out a temporary evacuation of the city's residents to nearby settlements of Kyiv Oblast. For that purpose, buses will be provided to every residence today, April 27th, beginning at 1400 hours, under the supervision of police officers and representatives of the City Executive Committee. It is recommended that people take documents, absolutely necessary items, and food products to meet immediate needs. All houses will be guarded by the police during the evacuation period. Comrades, on leaving your dwellings temporarily, please do not forget to close windows, switch off electrical and gas appliances, and turn off water taps. Please remain calm, organized, and orderly of this short-term evacuation.
We know from history this announcement was repeated multiple times to residents in the city right before they were supposed to evacuate. Some sources I saw mentioned giving the residents 2 hours, while others mentioned to them having less than an hour. In either case, there wasn't much time. Now, just take a step back here. Can you imagine? What would you do if there was an announcement like that where you live? This was a Saturday, so imagine you're out on the town during the weekend and you hear that being broadcast. What would you do? Would you believe it at first? Would the first thing you do be to rush home and pack all your belongings that you'll need for the rest of your life? I know I wouldn't. I'd wonder what's going on. Should we do what it's saying? Why is that being said? What in the world is going on? It says it's temporary, so it can't be that big of a deal, right? What we don't know from history is just how much everyone understood the seriousness of what it meant. How could they know this was evacuating their homes forever? Nothing about this announcement suggested they'd be leaving Pripyat to never return. Quite the opposite, actually. For the most part, the series is correct to show there wasn't a huge issue with the evacuation. Most people just did what they were told. Did they understand it? No, not necessarily. But they didn't need to understand. They did what they were told, and looking at it from a historical lens, we know that worked out for the best to leave the radioactive area near and around Chernobyl. If we go back into the series at the end of the second episode, we see the next attempt to slow the heat from continuing to rise. This comes in the form of trying to release water from tanks before the heated sand, basically a lava-like material at that point, hits the tanks. If they don't do that, the lava hitting the tank will instantly heat it up so fast it'll cause a thermal explosion that'll destroy the remaining reactors at Chernobyl and release so much radioactive material that millions of people will probably die. And entire regions like Belarusia and Ukraine will be completely uninhabitable for at least 100 years. To avoid this, they have to open the valves and release the water before that lava gets there. But the men who do that will be exposed to so much radiation, they'll likely die. According to the series, the three men who volunteer for this are Ananenko, Bezpilov, and Baranov. That whole scenario is true, even down to the names of the three men who were sent to try and avoid the disaster. But because the TV series shows more of this in the third episode, we'll actually talk about them a little bit more in our next episode as well. One thing we don't see in the series at all is that the boron they dumped along with the sand didn't make it to the core. The purpose was exactly what the series showed, to use a mixture of sand and boron, the sand to help smother the fires and the boron to absorb the neutrons to halt the continuing heat generated by the ongoing fission reaction. But now we know next to none of that boron even made it to the core. So it was kind of pointless. The reason we don't see that mentioned in the series, though, is that at that time, they didn't know that. We only know that now, looking at it through a historical lens. But that's just another example of how they tried to do the right thing. But what they tried ended up making things only worse. One thing they did know, though, was the detection of ruthenium. That's a chemical element that belongs to the platinum group on the periodic table, atomic number 44. The reason that's important is because they found the ruthenium was melting. And because they know the melting point for ruthenium is 2,250 degrees Celsius, or about 4,000 degrees Fahrenheit, that means the fires near the core were at least that hot. There are actually pictures and footage of the molten lava-like substance they managed to get, and I'll include links to those in the resources for this series if you want to get a visual. That basically meant they had a nuclear meltdown on their hands. Now, I know a nuclear meltdown is something we're all familiar with. By that, I mean, it's a term we've probably all heard. But if you're like me and not a nuclear engineer, what exactly does that mean? To understand that, we have to have some basic knowledge about how a nuclear reactor works. Again, we talked about that in the last episode too. So in that episode, we learned about parts like a control rod and the uranium used as nuclear fuel. To build on that knowledge, a nuclear meltdown occurs when the core gets so hot that the uranium melts. When it does that, it can burn through any casing and fall to the bottom of the reactor. Then as it continues to get hotter and hotter, it can turn into the molten lava-like material that they talk about in the series. That's what can burn through any of the protective layers in the reactor and eventually hit the ground itself. Once it does that, the only thing left is the Earth itself. Everything, including the water in the ground, gets contaminated by the radioactive molten uranium. Now, these days, there's usually a layer of metallic alloy beneath the reactor to catch things before they get to the Earth below. That's an added safety feature in the wake of the Chernobyl accident. And that means at Chernobyl, there was no extra safety feature in case of a meltdown. There was just a water reservoir that was used for the emergency cooling pumps. That water was what they were concerned about. The moment the meltdown hit that, it started a new chain reaction of destruction. The water would instantly heat up, turning it into steam, and an explosion that would hit the other three reactors at Chernobyl. And doing that would mean the nuclear fuel in those reactors would vaporize. And that's the explosion they were trying to avoid. The series is correct to show that some of the Soviet scientists working on the Chernobyl accident gave estimates that the potential explosion would basically flatten 200 square kilometers. That's about 77 square miles, poison all the water in the area, killing who knows how many of the 30 million people who use that drinking water and render Belarusia and Ukraine uninhabitable. Of course, thankfully, we can look back on this event through a historical lens and know that that did not happen. So that means it's all speculation on how terrible it could have been. But that's what they were afraid of happening. To avoid that, they needed to release the water from that reservoir. The challenge to that is, just like what we see in the series, the valves for that had to be turned by hand. Those valves were in the basement. And that basement was flooded with what was now radioactive water. That brings us back to the three men who volunteered to turn the valves. Alexei Ananenko, Valery Bezpilov, and Alexandrovich Baranov. And that story is something that we'll learn more of in episode number 3 of the miniseries. So we'll do the same here as we pick up next time and dig into the true story behind episode number 3 of HBO's Chernobyl. This episode of Based on a True Story was written and produced by me, Dan Lefebvre. If you want to learn more about the true story, I have a lot of great resources that I found in my research, from overall articles and timelines and explanations to technical papers written by scientists and engineers. All of those are found at the show's home on the web, basedonatruestorypodcast.com. But I want to mention three books in particular that I loved and found super helpful in researching this episode. The first, and these are in no particular order, but the first is simply called Chernobyl by Serhii Plokhii. The next, Midnight in Chernobyl by Adam Higginbotham. And then Chernobyl, 1-23-40, The Incredible True Story of the World's Worst Nuclear Disaster by Andrew Leatherbarrow. You can find links to those books, all the resources, and follow the entire Chernobyl series in one place over at basedonatruestorypodcast.com/Chernobyl. That's where all the episodes will be posted as they're released. Okay, now it's time for the answer to our two truths and a lie game from the beginning of the episode. As a refresher, here are the two truths and one lie. Number one, Legasov and Chertobina were both real people on the Chernobyl Commission, but Kumyuk was not. Number two, they really did drop sand and boron on Chernobyl. Number three, citizens were told to evacuate Pripyat with over 6 hours' notice. Did you find out which one is a lie? Let's go backwards and start with number three. Citizens were told to evacuate Pripyat with over 6 hours' notice. And right up front, we have the lie. As we learned, the announcement came less than an hour before they had to evacuate. Some sources I saw said they had about 50 minutes, while others did give up to 2 hours. But, and this is just my speculation, but I think a lot of that had to do with the simple fact that evacuating an entire city doesn't happen immediately. So some people had more time than others. The next is number two. They really did drop sand and boron on Chernobyl. That is true. What we see in the series here is true. They did drop that on the core to try to slow down both the fires and the fission reaction. And last but not least, we have number one. Legasov and Sherbina were both real people on the Chernobyl Commission, but Kumyuk was not. This is also true. While Valery Legasov and Boris Sherbina were both real people, the character of Ulana Kumyuk is a composite character whose actions in the series are meant to depict the hundreds of other scientists working on the Chernobyl accident. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. I hope you're enjoying this series. If you found it entertaining, if you find value in this podcast and you'd like to give a little bit of that value back, you can do that over at basedonatruestorypodcast.com/support. Once again, that's basedonatruestorypodcast.com/support. Until next time, thanks so much for listening, and I'll chat with you again really soon.